Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Crime Wire Investigates, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and to seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. I'd like to take a second just to introduce or just to say a few words. On Sunday evenings, there's another show that goes on, and it's called Crime Time with Vito Colucci, PI. So if you need more fill of crime, anything crime-related, please go on either the Business Talk Radio Network or the Lifestyle Talk Radio Network. And it's a nationwide show that goes right across the country with many affiliates. And it's, like I said, it's 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on Sunday nights. This Sunday show, I feature Levi Page, and it's called What You Always Wanted to Know About Levi Page, But Were Afraid to Ask. So we get down and dirty with Levi and a lot of things that the people don't know about his background and his, you know, what he's doing now. So it's very exciting. So listen, we have on our show our Crime Wire expert, which is investigator Pat Caristo. Pat, good to talk to you again.
Thank you very much for having me.
And just to let everybody know, you know, Pat's a little bit under the weather tonight. Susan Murphy Milano will not be with us tonight. She's very much under the weather. And so, you know, we're going to have a good show. We got Denny, myself, Pat Caristo, Gene Cervantes is going to be on. So I'm going to turn the first segment over to Denny Griffith. Take it, Denny.
Thanks, Vito. And, Pat, again, I echo Vito. Thank you for joining us tonight, especially when you're not feeling quite up to speed. We appreciate it. The first case we're going to discuss tonight is actually a double homicide out of Fresno County, California. It's a 2005 case. And unlike many of the other cases we discuss here on CrimeWire, this one actually had a successful conclusion. This is not one of the cases where there may have been a less than adequate investigation or someone may have dropped the ball. And we had hoped to have with us this evening Lieutenant Leo Lopez with the Fresno County, California Sheriff's Department. At the time of this investigation, he was the lead detective on the case. And Lieutenant Lopez had to pull out at the last moment. However, we do have on the air with us tonight our friend from Citizens Against Homicide, Gene Cervantes. Gene, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Denny.
And I think I'm going to give just a little basic background, Gene, and I'm going to turn it over to you and let you explain to the listeners not only about Citizens Against Homicide, but how else you fit into this case. So let me just give a brief introduction. In July of 2005, an elderly couple in Fresno County, California, were murdered, and very violent murders. And their names were Roy and his wife Angie Woodley. And they were stabbed. Roy was stabbed 28 times, Angie 14 times. And we're going to be discussing that case and how it evolved to a successful conclusion. But Gene, would you come in now, please, and just give the listeners an idea of your, in addition to the Citizens Against Homicide piece of this, your personal relationship to the case?
Thank you, Denny. When I was a youngster, my aunt passed away, and her daughter was, of course, Angie, as well as her sister, Eleanor, and brother, Ray. They came to live with us. So Angie was pretty much like a sister. My mom raised them. And, of course, when they reached adulthood, they moved out on their own. But we've always maintained contact. And I was sitting in my chair watching television one Friday evening, to be exact, July 22nd, 2005. And I got a phone call from my niece in Sacramento, and she says that she got a call from Fresno that Angie and Roy had been murdered. Well, you can certainly imagine how I felt. It was like a sledgehammer just whacked me in the chest, and I was just dumbfounded. And it turned out to be true. I made some phone calls, and it was true. And that took Shelley and I, my wife Shelley and I, on this journey to eventually hook up with Citizens Against Homicide. We made contact with the organization. I have a law enforcement background, and I still didn't know what to do. I reached out to Citizens, and Jane Alexander and Jan Miller both met with Shelley and I, and the next thing you know, we're attending meetings, and we eventually became victim advocates. And when we say to a caller or one of our clients, we know how you feel, we absolutely do. There's no question that what they're going through, the families and friends of murder victims go through the same thing. Our lives were changed forever, and Citizens was there to help us, and we were extremely grateful for that.
Now, Gene, when back to July 22nd, 2005, you found out, you got word that there had been this double homicide.
Yes.
At that point, let's just say in the initial stages, the first 24 hours or something, what type of information were you getting as far as a suspect or a perpetrator or an arrest or that type of thing? Were you getting any feedback of a scenario of what the police were thinking or what your relatives had to say? Were you getting any idea who may have been responsible?
Initially, there was nothing but chaos, Denny. There was, everyone was just shocked. Angie and Roy were the most passive, loving couple that you could know. And we immediately left our home and went down to Fresno to the daughter's home, and Angie had two daughters from a previous marriage, and Roy had some children from a prior marriage, and we talked about 24 hours. Well, actually, it was more like a few days. They arrested Roy, the stepson of my cousin and son of my cousin's husband, and within 48 hours they released him. So everybody thought that Philip, the son, was responsible, but nobody really hung their hat on it to the extent of campaigning, so to speak, for Philip to be rearrested.
So family members, some family members were at least initially a suspect, or what do they call them now, persons of interest or whatever.
Yeah, he was a person of interest, Philip was.
But was there anything about the murder, about the scene, that would have suggested it was not, somebody knows maybe a robbery or home invasion type thing? Was there any information that would have the police check that?
As a matter of fact, there was. It was ransacked. The police immediately said it was a staged ransacking, and we knew a little bit more about Roy's habits than the police at the time during the investigation. Roy was an upholsterer by trade, and he used to hide money in the furniture and then restitch the furniture in the entry of a door where the seams come together. He would hide money in the carpet, and all of that stuff was cut open with a knife. And so we knew, somebody knew that Roy hid money, and that was what the cutting of the carpet, the cutting of the furniture was about, looking for the money that they suspected Roy had hid.
It's dashed. And the lead or the primary police agency, if there was more than one, the primary would have been Fresno County?
Correct. Fresno County Sheriff's Office.
And Gene, the amount of stab wounds between the two of them, over 40, puts things, when you see these kind of cases, as you know and I know and Pat Caristo knows from working these cases and being on police departments, puts it in a whole different category when you have over 40 stab wounds. You got people don't understand. That takes a while to do. You got a person that is in a rage, could be very personal matter. It just puts it in a whole different category of somebody coming in with one or two shots or one or two stab wounds, which are bad enough as it is.
Right. And that's exactly what I concluded, and I was in contact with the law enforcement all the time, to the point where I was pretty much a pain to them, I guess. But I was asked by the daughters to be the family spokesperson, and with my background in law enforcement, I thought, well, maybe I could get a little professional courtesy, and sometimes I did, and most of the times I didn't, because it was an ongoing investigation, and I understood that. But part of what you're saying was brought out in the trial, Vito, when he, testimony, the key witness against Philip was describing him as, just like you said, in a rage. And he was just stabbing and stabbing and stabbing. He said he couldn't believe it.
And not only that, Gene, like you were saying before about, being a, possibly a pest with the police departments, what I have learned over the years, now that I don't wear the badge anymore and I go to the police departments, is that it's a feeling out process with the lead detective or detectives who's ever in there. You kind of get a gauge right from your first couple phone calls of what direction you're going to go, if they're going to be super cooperative with you. Sometimes you could tell on the first phone call where, what do you want? What could I do for you, type of a thing, but it's tough because you never know what kind of response you're going to get, how many times you're going to be able to call, two times a week or once every other week, depending on the the attitude and the personality of the investigating officer.
Yeah, you're right on there. He returned phone calls on a regular basis, and then there were no phone calls, and then I would have to call and. So, you know the process. I mean, sometimes they're busy and they just don't have time to call. So
it seems, if I may say, Gene, and now here you had a clear case that these were homicides. I mean, there was no one alleged it was a suicide like some of the cases that we talk about that, you know, that are suicides and their families think they're homicides. This was clearly homicide, and I agree that you can understand when they're investigating as a homicide, you know, that there's going to be certain information they're going to keep close and so forth. They don't want to jeopardize that. You realize that too. But did you work out with, and this would have been at the time, I believe, Sergeant Lopez? Was he a sergeant at the...
Sergeant Lopez.
Okay. Did you work out anything with him regarding contact? In other words, like once a week, or was there any kind of a format set up where you had some type of an arrangement or an agreement about contact?
No, I didn't. What I did was just the opposite. You know, I didn't try to work it out. I just said, okay, I think today is a good time to call him and get some information, sit back. We had made some contact with a local news anchor, Maureen Naylor of Channel 30 News there in Fresno, and she would do whatever she could to keep the double homicide in the public eye. Hopefully a witness would come forward, and then we would give her first crack at interviews, and it worked out pretty good. So when we, Shelley and I, would discuss the case and we'd say, okay, now what can we do? We were constantly thinking of our next step. And so in retrospect, I should have worked something out. And I encourage people who call citizens and call my office, please make sure that you have a positive relationship with the police, ask the investigative agency, I should say, ask them for permission to call. Make it so that they're getting the feeling that you're cooperating with them. You want them to be friendly as opposed to adversary, and work it out through them that you'll call them, like you said, a schedule. I'll call you once a month, once every 2 weeks, whatever.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, so in retrospect,
Pat,
I should have
hey,
been
Pat. Pat Caristo, why don't you jump in on this? What do you think about what you've heard so far on this case?
Well, I had a question about the murder itself. The violence of it strikes me one of two ways, that the killer had already rage and came in with the idea of killing, or was it he was in the process of trying to find the money, the couple came in, and there was that kind of confrontation. Which one was it?
He came in set to kill. He was predisposed to kill.
Okay.
He came in. He took my cousin to the back room, to back bedroom, had his friend put tape on Roy's hands. Roy had just gotten out of the shower, and anyway, he went to the back bedroom and killed my cousin, and came back out and stabbed, I guess I could say this now, his father.
Mm.
It was his son who did it.
How very sad.
He was yelling in a rage, like Vito had said, and he was constantly saying, repeating, you never gave me anything, you never gave me anything. And then he went into the kitchen to wipe off, rinse off the knife, and his partner said, what's that noise? And he heard Roy had gotten up, and he was bleeding profusely, and Philip went back out there and stabbed him again repeatedly, and finally killed him.
Wow.
So, yes, it was personal.
Pat?
Yes.
I just, you know, we've been talking a little bit about the relationships between the victim's family and the police. if you could put your detective's hat on, your police detective's hat on for a minute. How did you handle it when you were doing investigations as a police officer? How would you interact with the family members? Did you try to, for example, say, okay, call me, you know, we'll have a call every 2 weeks unless something breaks and I'll let you know right away? Or did you just prefer not to have any kind of a formal arrangement with the families as far as sharing information? What worked best for you?
We had a mandate from the department to try to stay in touch. Our reports were due in, for example, on missing persons cases. We had to get the report in. You couldn't just let things hang, and therefore you had to keep in contact with families. But not every department has the same philosophy. I think it should be mandated that the case investigator send a note, just a handwritten note letter, to their families to say, we're in the progress of the investigation, or especially when there's been a change in the assigned detective. In other words, that the police department, the investigating department, has an obligation to be the one to be in contact. They are the ones who are the servant. The families are the victims. And it's a shame that families have to take that role when many times they're not able to fill that role. And they were very lucky in this case to have Gene to be their advocate.
Do you agree with me, and maybe Gene will too, that I think Gene mentioned the shock effect of getting this news about the two murders. And I think a lot of families, I think in certain cases, this is where there's a breakdown. Because the families, if they don't have law enforcement background, if they go into this shock thing, and of course they trust their law enforcement agency or agencies that are handling the case to do everything right in the right way. And I think sometimes the families don't think about maybe safeguarding computers, maybe, you know, and there's a lot of things. Do you think sometimes that there's a breakdown that later on surfaces after it's too late because the family is perhaps in shock? They just have, you know, trust in the police agency, and they don't maybe do things that, in hindsight, if they had it to do over again, they might have handled things a little differently. Do you think that ever happened?
Oh, absolutely, and that's the value of agencies like Gene's Citizens Against Homicide. I used to be with New Mexico Survivors of Homicide, and we would do exactly that. We would provide the new families. We would get the information from the medical examiner that a violent crime murder had occurred, and we would make contact by a letter explaining that we were here to be advocates, information sources, and let the people know, the families know, how they might keep record of calls, document things, set aside information in a special folder. I designed a special folder for them. It helped them feel like they were cooperating in the investigation of their loved one's mm-hmm. death. But it is a frightening and overwhelming thing when your family member, loved one is murdered.
And
a regular death is enough, but the extra that goes along with the unfairness of a homicide, a murder, just adds to it.
Gene, let me get back to the investigation piece of this. Now there was that initial arrest where they held one of the sons, I guess Roy, it was for 48 hours or something. But Philip, how was the progress of the investigation after this suspect was turned loose?
Well, after that, it pretty much went cold, Denny. There was a lot of, well, let me back up. It went cold as far as the family was concerned. However, we found out in court that they were actively investigating and they were doing things that we had absolutely no idea they were doing, and part of which were wiretaps with subpoenas. And not only on the landline, but on the cell phones, they were doing just a variety of different things that convinced me was an excellent job of police work. And when Jane Alexander got us a billboard with a $50,000 reward that was issued by the governor, they went up around Fresno area, and Philip came out of the woodwork with a binder and a makeshift press conference saying, "I know who did it." Well, he wanted the reward. And, the co-offender immediately fled the county saying, "You're not going to pin this on me." Mm-hmm. Went to a neighboring county with the sheriff's office, told them what happened. They called Fresno. Fresno went down to audio and video deposition, and he said, "I want to make a deal." He took 18 years and was a key witness against Philip in the double homicide, and that's how we were able to bring a conclusion.
And Gene, how do you feel now, in looking back, how do you feel about these sentences? How do you feel about the whole ending of this?
Well, I feel very good, because I don't believe that the co-defender, Jeffrey Rancourt, would have been able to testify, or would have been willing to testify, had he not been given the deal. I am extremely happy that Philip, the son, the murderer, received two life without possibility of parole sentences consecutive.
I think that's an interesting thing you said, though, Gene, that our listeners need to understand on these cases, since we see it all the time. Sometimes that one person has to get a much lesser sentence for their involvement, and a lot of times the public can't understand that. But you want to solve this whole case, and like you said, the murderer, he was able to get the murderer, and that is the key in an investigator's mind when you get that far, right? Am I right with that?
Absolutely, and you know, Vito, the district attorney was, I mean, just outstanding. He did an extremely good job of very methodical in pointing out this and that and this and that, and just took the jury through the crime step by step. And when there was a deal being formulated with the co-offender, he was in contact with the family, well, me, and he says they wanted 12 years. And and the district attorney said, "No, 24. And he said, "Well, let's try 18. Well, the defendant said, "Nope, I want 12. They said, "You're going down for first-degree murder." And next thing you know, it scared the hell out of him, and he says, "I'll take the deal, 18 years.
Right. That's a good way to explain it to the listeners, how that all happened, you know.
And,
but, you know, we talk about so many cases, Gene, as you know, because you're on so many times with us, that are frustrating to talk about, frustrating to the listeners listening in. But it's nice when you get the ones, and many of them are solved across the country. It's nice to highlight something like that and show the excellent police work that goes on in the majority of the time, and the hard work and the dedication and the good district attorneys, prosecutors around the country that put these things together. You know, Gene?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's just kind of like a mixed emotions. You're happy that a conviction was gotten, but at the same time you're sad and that you lost two wonderful people.
Vito, you hit on something, about being nice for a change to see a successful conclusion, which the police worked with the family, and there was some relationship there. And at CrimeWire, I'll mention it tonight, we want to recognize good police work. And we're opening up a new page on our website called Top Cops, and it's going to be CrimeWire's Top Cops. And
very good, very good.
Yeah, anybody who has, knows of a case that involved police work, good police work, obviously, and also involved a relationship with the family. That's one of the points we want to stress, that the families mm-hmm. and the police can work as allies. They do not have to be adversaries. And so if anyone is aware of cases like that where the lead detective or whatever or the agency deserves some recognition, we'd love to hear from you.
That's a good point, Denny, because I'm sure Pat can identify too, like I can as ex-cops. A lot of times we talk about cases. In fact, the next case we're going to talk about is things that weren't done properly. But it's nice because the majority of the time we could say kudos and give props to the police for good work. And do you agree with me, Pat, on that?
Absolutely. And the more they hear good things, the more, like anything else, you want to hear good things. And if you reinforce good behavior, you'll get good behavior.
Okay, speaking of that, we do have to move on to the second segment. And, Gene, this case we're going to discuss next that Vito is going to introduce to you is a case that was originally referred to us by Citizens Against Homicide. So Gene is going to remain with us for the next case. Vito?
Okay. The next case here. Ivan Fogelsong case. Ivan Fogelsong, known to friends and family as Bud, died July 21, 2007 in Sacramento, California, following injuries sustained from a suspicious explosion at a family-owned cabin. Only 2 weeks from retirement and over 12,000 hours of flight time during his aviation career, Bud had the honor of flying both President George W. Bush and President Jimmy Carter during his military career. He was an MD-11 senior captain with World Airways. After graduating from Mississippi State University, he joined the Air Force and distinguished himself as an outstanding aviator during a 24-year career. He was a Vietnam and Gulf War veteran, and he received numerous service medals during his career. Just to give you additional little background, around 5 o'clock on the afternoon of the incident, Bud said he was going to a small house on the property a little less than a mile away. The cabin was used as a base for duck hunting and a rest area for employees. When Bud entered the cabin, a fire broke out, possibly as the result of an explosion. Although he was in shock, Bud somehow managed to drive back to the house. Upon entering the house, he said it exploded. Arson and bomb detectives were called to the cabin. Their investigation determined the fire was a result of arson. Joining us to discuss the case, Tim Cruz, reporter with the Sacramento Valley Mirror, Bernice Reed, family friend, and, of course, Gene Cervantes from Citizens Against Homicide. Welcome, everybody.
Good evening.
Tim, what I just read, is that fairly accurate since you're one of the main reporters on this case?
This is very close to the bone. The cabin is at the west end of a family farm compound of a half a dozen ranch houses from the Hoseapple family. The Hoseapples are the ranch is managed by Herb Hoseapple, the brother-in-law of the deceased, and Glenn County District Attorney Bob Hoseapple also grew up on the ranch. What isn't said is that there was an indictment due in a couple of days before Bud's death of Roy Hoseapple, his nephew, as a result of a beating that a much larger Roy Hoseapple meted out to his uncle, crushing a finger, a crime that was pretty well covered up at the county level, but the California Attorney General was bringing an indictment. And with Bud's death, of course, the indictment disappeared.
Mm, That's right. That's right. Hey, Bernice, tell us a little bit about the family situation, both back then and how it is now.
Well, back then there was a lot of tension because they were trying to settle the father's estate. The father died in 2005, and there was a that when Bud's finger was damaged, Roy Hoseapple was upset about a letter written by the attorney for the DA and kept accusing Bud of writing it, and Bud said, "No, I didn't." And this is all documented by Bud to a letter to Officer Goodwin explaining exactly what happened. And somehow all of this evidence, pictures, everything, disappeared in the DA's office. And Bud worked very, very hard through the victim's advocate in Willows to get in touch with the AG who came up to Willows to interview Roy Hoseapple and Bud the night before Roy Hoseapple cancels out. He's not going to go for the interview. Bud goes for the interview. Shortly after that, Mr. Zoll decides that he will indict Roy. And he asked Bud, and I had a conversation with Bud 5 days before he died, and this is what he told me, that Mr. Zoll had asked him what he would think was an appropriate punishment for Roy. And he gave four things: anger management, Roy to pay his medical bills, 1,000 hours of community service, and the AG said with or without an orange jumpsuit, and Bud said not necessary, and a letter of apology. And the AG said in the newspaper, Bud said not necessary. This is a guy who was not vindictive, who just wanted justice.
That certainly sounds that way, Bernice. Those four things you read is really above and beyond just him, you know, wanting to have this fella take the anger management, do some community service. No, I don't necessarily want him in jail. No, let him do this, this, and that to help himself. That's an excellent way of thinking that he had on this, you know.
Gene, exactly. Going to Bud's character, I think it's very important that people understand this. Although the investigators of this incident weren't able to get it together to contact any of his colleagues or friends, my little newspaper was able to find a couple dozen of them, interview them. Everybody said there was nothing in Bud's character that was either vindictive nor violent, that he wouldn't just snap, as the sheriff's office opined at one point.
Right.
You know, he was an exemplary guy, went out of the way for his friends, and under pressure, such as landing an MD-11 at the Hong Kong airport when it was nearly out of fuel, never panicked. He
wow.
was not in his character to do that. What disturbs me, among many things about the investigation, was that nobody in the Sheriff Coroner's office here in California, they're combined, nobody managed to do what the CHP does, which is a standard, let's look at the last 72 hours, nor to do what you should do, is to look at the medical records. You know, look at his psych profiles, look at his military history. You know, why would he set anything on fire, as Herb said he did, when he knew so much about the behavior of petroleum products from being a tanker pilot? It's just, the whole thing is ridiculous.
Now, Tim, let me ask you this. How's your relationship as an investigative reporter with the police officers working this case?
I don't know. Travis Goodwin, Sergeant Goodwin, was in here the other day. You know, we're on cordial terms.
Right.
The sheriff said to me not long ago, "You don't run the sheriff's office," and I said, "Neither do you." You know, there's some. We've done 41 stories or 42 stories on this so far.
Have you? Wow! Well, I give you. See, that's something I like to hear, Tim. I mean, I've talked about this. I've worked high-profile cases, and I tell the people all the time, always hook up with a good investigative reporter that's going to stand his ground and do what he has to do. And how many? What's the track record of the cops in this case? Like, what? How many of these type cases do they get usually?
They don't get very many. I mean, they've solved maybe one or two murders here in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. There's as one former DA investigator who lives in our county said, the bodies keep stacking up. We did have a fellow shot in the head and burned up in a building here a few months ago, and so they put up a $1,000 reward. It's a drug case. Well, you're not going to get anybody in the drug community to come forward for $1,000. They're not very efficient. If you look at the investigation of Bud's death and look at it closely, we have the evidence book, you'll see officers put on it, pulled off. The best and most reliable ones were allowed to be on it for maybe 10 days. We waited a year here at the Mirror before we even started to give them a chance to get it done.
Right.
They put somebody on for a few days, and then they just go willy-nilly off to something else. The initial theory put forward by the executor of the estate the night of the fire was almost instantly that Bud had set the place on fire, and they burned it and burned himself up, which makes no sense. Even if you were in a state of mind to want to get some revenge or to even a score,
right,
which I want to emphasize is not his character, but if you were to do that, you wouldn't burn up this useless old duck hunter's cabin. There is a huge barn full of family memorabilia and antique equipment. There were equipment sheds with extremely valuable pieces of farm equipment that were maybe 10 or 20 paces away. This was so bungled that they didn't even fingerprint the nozzle of a nearby gasoline tank that was maybe 30 or 40 feet from this thing.
Yeah, I got a laundry list here, Tim.
It's worse.
And I want to ask Bernice something. Bernice, I'm going to read one of the problems with this investigation, and you give me your comments on it, okay? During the initial investigation, the family members who had last been with Bud on the day he died were not interviewed. His daughter, Ann, who was the last person to speak with him, was interviewed a full 6 months after the fire. What do you think about all of that?
Well, I felt that they never took the whole thing seriously. They didn't. They just went through the motions, and they did a very poor job of doing that. They had decided the night of the fire, Bud did it, and they were not really going to investigate anything. They didn't really. They didn't talk to anyone. They didn't. How can I say this? They never took evidence. If the night of the fire, George Morris III, the rookie fire investigator, goes over there and shovels all of the evidence away, and they didn't even bother to pick up the simple thing of the door handle. 6 months later, Jan and I go down to the cabin, and the door handle that he opened the door with was still laying around. There was all these things that they may have gleaned some evidence, but they made no effort to.
Yeah, I mean, what's amazing, I mean, the police department that I served on, as well as the police departments I know, not only in Connecticut but across the country, when I read some of these problems with this case, it's almost like it's a fiction made-up movie. That's how bizarre this is. I mean, this rookie fire investigator, his batteries on his equipment run down, and he doesn't complete the test, and then the analysis was never performed. The clothing was not secured in any kind of containers for 8 hours. Chain of custody was unclear. The nurses and the people that treated Fogelson, they weren't even interviewed. What do you feel about this, Tim, as an investigative reporter? This, I mean, you got enough fodder to go on for a while when you write these stories, right?
Well, of course, but the thing that disturbs me was that when I finally figured it out, and this is large part due to some great researchers, is that the fire chief, one of the fire investigators, other detectives all went to high school together. They went to high school with Roy Hoseapple, with other members of the Hoseapple family. This is a very small place. I've often said that what we need more than anything else is fresh DNA. It's just too small and too clubby and too chummy. And the fact is that the DA is answerable, was answerable to no one until the vote came this June, and he lost 60-30.
Mm-hmm.
But these little DAs are complete gods unto themselves. Herb is a very powerful man. It's the day after Bud was burnt, within hours of him dying, Herb Hoseapple says to his sister, the widow, "Don't worry, Jan, you'll have a new man in 6 months." Now, I submit to you that with that kind of an attitude, that is so callous and so cruel that, and he's on the scene right away saying, Bud did it, everybody's going to follow the leader.
Can I ask a question about the this cabin? How frequently before the fire incident had Bud visited the cabin? Is this something that is sitting there, nobody uses it, and he went there that day on a spur, or was it a regular visit to this cabin?
I'll answer that. Bud would was a pilot and not used to being out in the country and being in cities. Every afternoon, he would get in his pickup and take a drive around the ranch just to get out of the house. So it's 2 miles down there, and it's about a three-mile circle or trip that he'd do in the afternoon. This was a normal thing.
Okay.
Would he go to the cabin every day? No. He would drive by the cabin and probably do a U-turn there because further down there was just hay barns, and so he would probably do a U-turn. So something was either... Something was strange about the cabin that drew him in that evening.
The reason I ask this, and I don't know whether it is, but my investigative instincts ask, something was going on. The cabin was being used for something, possibly drug cooking?
No, I don't think so.
No, it's too
isolated. I don't mean that Bud was doing it, but somebody was using it.
Too isolated. It's 2 miles from the nearest road. No one goes in there. And it just wouldn't have been feasible. No. It was something else that someone may have been in there and called to him. We don't know. Did he smell smoke? Was there the door ajar, the screen door on the porch? We don't know. We will never know those answers.
And you don't know whether the fire was set to hurt Bud or whether he was hurt accidentally by the fire.
We don't have that answer.
Okay.
Hey, Dennis,
we don't have the answer to the shrapnel wounds either.
No.
And it's important to know that when Bud went down to the cabin this particular day, that he'd planned to go down there with his daughter-in-law, with whom he'd spent the whole day, Megan, after putting his son, the helicopter pilot, bound for Iraq on the Sacramento airport. They spent the entire day together. Megan, his daughter-in-law, and the baby, the granddaughter, were going to take this little tour of the ranch together. The baby was hungry, so Megan said, I'll catch up in a minute. She was just about to leave, and it was only this accident of nature that they all three of them weren't together when he was on the little tour.
I'd like to say that I was visiting with Bud and Jan 3 days before he died on the Wednesday. We went over to see the youngest son, Jed, who was going to Iraq on his first tour of duty in the Marines. And Bud was so happy that finally he was going to get justice about his finger being destroyed by Roy Hozapfel, that he was going to be indicted the next week. And he made a great point to me that he wanted to be very, very careful because he didn't want anything to interfere with this indictment. So it doesn't follow through that this guy who, as I stated, is not vindictive, would have done anything like start a fire.
Definitely. I want to get Denny and Gene on this. What are you guys hearing here? You've been listening to everybody talking about it. Denny, with your amazing background, and Gene, what are you guys hearing and feeling on this?
Go ahead, Denny.
I was just going to say, not being familiar with the area and the politics and so forth, but it seems to me they're a very powerful family here, and a lot of these people, DAs and people in charge of this or in charge of that, and had to bring the AG in for the one assault battery complaint because of the conflicts. We've had other cases, and I think some of the families have referred to situations like that as the Good Old Boys Network. It sounds to me like that might be an accurate description in this case. But is the manner of death as we speak tonight, is it considered an accident?
It was originally ruled a suicide. After a few months, the sheriff coroner changed that from a suicide by arson to an accident. Now it goes to an inquest at the end of the month to a coroner's jury. And there hasn't been a coroner's jury here for 30 or 40 years or more. To answer your question, as it stands now, it's an accident. But one can hardly say that makes any sense.
Danny, can I say something real quick?
Yeah, go ahead, Gene.
There's been so much said about this case by the local law enforcement agencies that is contradictory, just doesn't match up to the facts. Like Tim had...
Now, Gene, what do you mean? The statements they're giving or what? What
yeah,
are they doing?
Statements. They first say accident. I'm sorry, suicide. Then they say accident. And I believed the arms of Bud showed defensive wounds. And then
correct.
Some shrapnel type wounds that they haven't bothered to explain.
And Gene, one other thing, in a round table, and then I need to get off because I've got to deliver papers.
Sure.
In a round table with Jan and Jed, and I think Bernice was there, I'm not sure, but
yes,
Lieutenant Warren, who is the head of major crimes, told Jan Fogelsong that Bud had taken a can of gasoline and poured it over his head and set himself on fire.
That's what I was leading up to.
And that was just the most bizarre statement possible. And then they later denied making the statement, and there were several witnesses to the statement being made.
Unbelievable.
And they couldn't find the gas tank, from my understanding.
No.
Tim, to you before you for you have to leave, Tim Cruz. When I worked undercover, I had an investigative reporter, Anthony Dolan, that went on to win a Pulitzer for his writing. He did. I don't know if you're familiar when he went to work for Ronald Reagan. He did 8 dozen stories on the stuff going on in my city. So I want the listeners to understand the reason I said all that is this isn't an investigative reporter we're talking to tonight, folks. This is what we talk about every week when I suggest to people find an honest reporter in the next town or somebody that doesn't have ties to anybody that will go in there and take a stand on cases. So keep this guy in mind. This is a guy that's doing great work, and I just want to thank you, Tim. I know you have to run.
Thank you all so much.
Thanks,
you know,
Tim.
You must understand that Bernice probably is the smartest one of us all. So I'll see you later.
Thanks, Tim.
Bernice, give us some closing things here. We got so many of us trying to
this
say.
This is a very, very well-documented case. From the first, Bud has written letters to Officer Goodwin about the assault. He has letters to the AG. We got the evidence book, the Fogelsong family, probably around in November. And I immediately started reading it, and I taking a mind map and mapping it out, and contradictory statements between the witnesses, Herb and Roy. Roy says, Herb called me when I was at the market, and he has documentation saying he left at 5:25. Well, Herb doesn't call 911 until 5:37. So here we have 12 minutes that Roy knew about the fire before 911 was called. Jan had asked Lieutenant Warren, when did Herb call? Because we saw he was one of the reporting witnesses. Well, we don't keep track of it. Well, not until we got the second copy of the evidence book on July 18th of 2008 was the call log in there. Herb Hoseapple was the first one. And they never give you a straight answer. The thing that's so frustrating for us is they're at best they mislead you with their answers, deliberately saying something. Well, for example, we don't keep track of them after the first couple. Well, Herb was the first one, so why not state that? They give you an answer, and then later on you find out that it was totally. Not a lie, but deliberately misleading. And all of the information and statement witnesses in the evidence book that we can go back and say he said this and he said that, and the times don't make sense, they don't do anything about it. They just don't. They don't answer you. It is extremely disturbing.
It definitely is. I am so happy that you are a spokesperson for the family. I have that role in a sentencing coming up in a couple of weeks on a murder charge, and I'm so glad you know the case. Just like Tim says, you know it inside out. Denny, give me let's wrap up with you telling me your thoughts just to end this segment, and then we'll do the same thing with Gene.
Yeah, I just wanted to say we had a caller, and I tried to answer the call and apparently dropped it. So, caller from area code 405, if you're still listening, I'll get you right on if you want to call back with a question or comment. What I'd like to do, if I could, is Jed Fogelsong was Bud's son. He's a Marine Corps officer. And I wanted to take just a minute and read an open letter that he posted in the newspaper on August 7th, just a couple of days ago. And I believe this was in the Mirror. Am I correct, Bernice?
You are correct.
Okay. It says, to Sergeant Goodwin, this is the sergeant who apparently was the lead investigator.
Lead detective.
And this is from Jed. I have never had your personal cell phone number. I've never spoken with you, even though you were the lead investigator on my father's case. The only contact I've had with you was over 2 years ago when my family and I attended a roundtable discussion with the sheriff and one of your colleagues, Lieutenant Warren. We were told that the case was solved. Our father killed himself. According to the lieutenant who assisted you in my father's case, my father doused himself in gasoline and then lit a match. That was some fine police work, with the exception that you couldn't support it at all. It would be an understatement to say there's an absence of trust between the Fogelsong family and yourself. You can feel disheartened all you want by this revelation. My concern is not for your feelings, but how you do your job. You jumped to conclusions about the actions and intentions of my father and then came to an egregiously negative conclusion. We did contact you multiple times to give you information important to the case. How many months went by before the time was right to come and interview my sister? Let's not forget that you've never interviewed my wife. The difference here is that you all but ignored us when you were trying to discuss a case involving a man's untimely death, but then you jump when you get a question about a court process? Yes, I am implying that you are not fair or honest and are, in fact, playing favorites. Captain Jed Fogelsong, Corpus Christi, Texas. I think that kind of sums up what the feeling is from at least one member of the Fogelsong family toward this particular investigator, if not the whole department, but at least to... to this Sergeant Goodwin.
That's called righteous anger, Denny, where, you know, you're just setting out everything right out there on the table, and, you know, you don't want to be quiet because you see injustices, you see numerous things that are done wrong. And, Bernice, before we close here, I just want to tell you to keep fighting the good fight for this family. And you're doing a heck of a job. You know the case, like Tim says, inside out, and we want to thank you for being on here tonight.
Thank you.
And Gene, do you have any closing comments?
Well, I'm just Citizens Against Homicide has been working with the family for a number of months, and we're hoping that the inquest scheduled for the 30th and 31st of August will render results that will, in fact, open an investigation, a full investigation, impartial.
Good, Gene. Good.
So.
Excellent.
And will you let us know how that comes out, Gene? So we'd like
to
do an update.
Yes, we sure will.
And that's the end of this month?
Correct.
Yes, August 30th and 31st.
Okay. Well, Echo Vito, thank you very much for being on with us tonight. It's certainly a bizarre case and hopefully one that will find a successful resolution.
Yes,
wow.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. Thank you, Bernice, and we'll be talking with you.
Well, you know, thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Or hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard. When there is nowhere else to turn, visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Many people were listening to this show tonight, especially about this California case. So good night and God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and God bless.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Pat.
Good night.
Good night.